possible. When other automobile manufacturers raise their prices, Ford lowers his. When other employers lower wages, Ford increases them. What has happened? This policy has placed the law of increasing returns back on Ford so effectively that he's become the richest and most powerful man in the world. Oh, you foolish and short-sighted seekers after wealth, who are returning from the daily chase empty-handed. Why do you not take a lesson from men like Ford? Why do you not reverse your philosophy and give an order that you may get? I am finishing this lesson on Christmas Eve. In the room next to my study, our children are decorating their Christmas tree, and the rhythm of their voices falls as music upon my ears. They are happy, not alone because they expect to receive, but for the deeper reason that they have presents hidden away which they expect to give. From the window of my study, I can see the neighbor's children as they, too, are gleefully engaged in preparing for this wonderful event. Throughout the civilized world, millions of people are preparing to celebrate the birth of this Prince of Peace, who more than any other man set forth the reason why it is more blessed to give than to receive, and why enduring happiness comes not from possessing material wealth, but from rendering service to humanity. It seems a queer coincidence that the completion of this particular lesson should have happened on Christmas Eve. Yet I am glad that it has, for this has provided me with sufficient justification for reminding you that nowhere in the entire history of civilization could I have found stronger support of the fundamentals of this lesson than may be found in the Sermon on the Mount in the book of Matthew. Christianity is one of the greatest and most far-reaching influences in the world today. And I hardly need apologize for reminding you that the tenets of Christ's philosophy are in absolute harmony with the fundamentals upon which this lesson in the main is founded. As I see the happy faces of the children and watch the hurrying crowds of belated Christmas shoppers, all radiant with the splendor of the spirit of giving, I cannot help wishing that every Eve was Christmas Eve. For then this would be a better world in which the struggle for existence would be reduced to a minimum and hatred and strife outlawed. Life is but a short span of years at best. Like a candle, we are lighted, flicker for a moment, and then go out. If we were placed here for the purpose of laying up treasures for use in a life that lies beyond the dark shadow of death, may it not be possible that we can best collect these treasures by rendering all the service we can to all the people we can, in a loving spirit of kindness and sympathy. I hope you agree with this philosophy. Here this letter must end, but it is by no means completed. Where I lay down the chain of thought, it is now your duty to take it up and develop it, in your own way, and to your own benefit. For the very nature of the subject of this lesson, it can never be finished, for it leads into the heart of all human activities. Its purpose is to cause you to take the fundamentals upon which it is based and use them as a stimulus that will cause your mind to unfold, thereby releasing the latent forces that are yours. This lesson was not written for the purpose of teaching you, but it was intended as a means of causing you to teach yourself one of the great truths of life. It was intended as a source of education in the true sense of educating, drawing out, developing from within these forces of mind which are available for your use. When you deliver the best service of which you are capable, striving each time to excel all your previous efforts, you are making use of the highest form of education. Therefore, when you render more service and better service than that for which you are paid, you are, more than anyone else, profiting from the effort. It is only through the delivery of such service that mastery in your chosen field of endeavor can be attained. For this reason, you should make it a part of your definite chief aim to endeavor to surpass all previous records in all that you do. Let this become a part of your daily habit, and follow it with the same regularity with which you eat your meals. Make it your business to render more service and better service than that for which you are paid and low. Before you realize what has happened, you will find that the world is willingly paying you for more than you do. Compound interest upon compound interest is the rate that you will be paid for such service. Just how this pyramiding of gains takes place is left entirely for you to determine. Now, what are you going to do with that which you have learned from this lesson, and when? and how and why. This lesson can be of no value to you unless it moves you to adopt and use the knowledge it has brought you. Knowledge becomes power only through organization and use. Do not forget this. You can never become a leader without doing more than you are paid for, and you cannot become successful without developing leadership in your chosen occupation. The Mastermind, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. A power that can bring you whatever you want on this earth. Success is achieved through the application of power. In the picture at the top of this page, you see two forms of power. At the left, you see physical power produced by nature with the aid of organized raindrops pouring over Niagara Falls. Man has harnessed this form of power. At the right, you see another and much more intensive form of power produced through the harmonious coordination of thought in the minds of men. Observe the word harmonious has been emphasized. In this picture, you see a group of men seated at the director's table in a modern business office. The powerful figure rising above the group represents the mastermind, which may be created whenever men blend their minds in a spirit of perfect harmony with some definite objective in view. Study this picture. It interprets the greatest power known to man. With the aid of the mind, man has discovered many interesting facts about the earth on which he lives, the air and the ether that fills the endless space about him, and the millions of other planets and heavenly bodies that float through space. With the aid of a little mechanical contrivance, which his mind conceived, called a spectroscope, man has discovered at the distance of 93 million miles the nature of the substance of which the sun is made. We have lived through the Stone Age, the Iron Age, the Copper Age, the religious fanatic age, the scientific research age, the industrial age, and we enter now the age of thought. Out of the spoils of the dark ages through which man has passed, he has saved much material that is sound food for thought. While for more than 10,000 years the battle between ignorance, superstition, and fear on the one side, and intelligence on the other has raged, man has picked up some useful knowledge. Among other fragments of useful knowledge gathered by man, he has discovered and classified the 83 elements of which all physical matter consists. By study and analysis and comparison, man has discovered the bigness of the material things in the universe, as they are represented by the suns and the stars, some of them over 10 million times as large as the earth on which he lives. On the other hand, man has discovered the littleness of things. By reducing matter to molecules, atoms, and finally to the smallest known particle, the electron. An atom is so inconceivably small that a grain of sand contains millions of them. The molecule is made up of atoms, which are said to be little particles of matter that revolve around each other in one continuous circuit, at lightning speed, very much as the Earth and other planets whirl around the sun in an endless circuit. The atom, in turn, is made up of electrons, which are constantly in rapid motion. Thus it is said that in every drop of water, in every grain of sand, the entire principle upon which the whole universe operates is duplicated. How marvelous, how stupendous, how do we find these things to be true? Through the aid of mind. You may gather some slight idea of the magnitude of it all the next time you eat a steak. By remembering that the steak on your plate, the plate itself, and the table on which you are eating, and the silverware with which you are eating are all, in final analysis, made of exactly the same material, electrons. In the physical or material world, whether one is looking at the largest star that floats to the heavens, or the smallest grains of sand to be found on earth, the object under observation is but an organized collection of molecules, atoms, and electrons. An electron is an inseparable form of power, made up of a positive and a negative pole. Man knows much about the physical facts of the universe. The next great scientific discovery will be the fact, which already exists, that every human brain is both a broadcasting and a receiving station, that every thought vibration released by the brain may be picked up and interpreted by all other brains that are in harmony or in tune with the rate of vibrations of the broadcasting brain. How did man acquire the knowledge that he possesses concerning the physical laws of this earth? How did he learn what has taken place before his time and during his uncivilized period? He gathered this knowledge by turning back the pages of nature's Bible, and there viewing the unimpeachable evidence of millions of years of struggle among animals of lower intelligence. By turning back the great stone of pages, man has uncovered the bones, skeletons, footprints, and other unmistakable evidence which Mother Nature has held for his inspection throughout unbelievable periods of time. Now man is about to turn his attention to another section of nature's Bible, the one wherein has been written a history of the great mental struggle that has taken place in the realm of thought. This page is represented by the boundless ether which has picked up and still carries every thought vibration that was ever released from the mind of man. This great page in nature's Bible is one that no human being has been able to tamper with. It records are positive, and soon they may be clearly interpreted. No interpolations by man have been permitted. Of the authenticity of the story written on this page, there can be no doubt. Thanks to education, meaning the unfolding, educing, drawing out, developing from within of the human mind, nature's Bible is now being interpreted. The story of man's long, perilous struggle upward has been written on the pages of this, the greatest of all Bibles. All who have partly conquered the six basic fears described in another author's visit in this series, and who have successfully conquered superstition and ignorance, may read the records that have been written in nature's Bible. To all others, this privilege is denied. For this reason, there are probably fewer than 1,000 people in the entire world at this time who are in even the primary grade as far as the reading of this Bible is concerned. In the entire world, there are probably fewer than 100 people today who know anything about or have ever heard of the chemistry of the mind through which two or more minds may be blended in a spirit of perfect harmony in such a manner that there is born a third mind possessing the superhuman power to read the story of the vibration of thought as it has been written and now exists in the imperishable records of the ether. The newly discovered radio principle has shut the mouths of the doubting Thomases and sent the scientists scurrying into new fields of experimentation. When they emerge from this field of research, they will show us that the mind as we understand it today, as compared to the mind of tomorrow, is about the same as comparing the intelligence of a polywog to that of a professor of biology who has read the entire lifeline of animal life from the amoeba on up to man. Come for a short visit with a few of the powerful men now living who are making use of powerful created through the blending in the spirit of harmony of two or more minds. We will begin with three well-known men who are known to be men of great achievement in their respective fields of endeavor. Their names are Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and Harvey Firestone. Of the three, Henry Ford is the most powerful, having reference to economic power. Mr. Ford is the most powerful man now living on earth and is believed to be the most powerful who ever lived. So great is his power that he may have anything of physical nature that he desires, or its equivalent. Millions of dollars to him are but playthings, no harder to acquire than the grains of sand with which the child builds sand tunnels. Mr. Edison has such a keen insight into Mother Nature's Bible that he has harnessed and combined for the good of man more of nature's laws than any other man who ever lived. It was he who brought together the point of a needle and a piece of wax in such a way that they could record and preserve the human voice. It was he who first made the lightning serve to light our houses and streets through the aid of the incandescent light. It was he who made the camera record and produce all sorts of motion through the modern moving picture apparatus. Mr. Firestone's industrial achievement is so well known that it needs no comment. He has made dollars multiply themselves so rapidly that his name has become a byword wherever automobiles are operated. All three men began their business and professional careers with no capital and but little schooling of the nature usually referred to as education. Perhaps Mr. Ford's beginning was by far the most humble of the three. Cursed with poverty, retarded by lack of even the most elementary form of schooling, and handicapped by ignorance in many forms, he has mastered all of these in the inconceivably short period of 25 years. Thus might we briefly describe the achievements of three well-known, successful men of power. but we have been dealing with effect only. The true philosopher wishes to know something of the cause which produced these desirable effects. It is a matter of public knowledge that Mr. Ford, Mr. Edison, and Mr. Firestone are close personal friends, that they go away to the woods once a year for a period of recuperation and rest. But it is not generally known, it is doubtful if these three men themselves even know it, that there exists between the three men a bond of harmony out of which has grown a mastermind that is being used by each of the three, a mind of superhuman ability that has the capacity to tune in on forces which most men are to no extent familiar. Let us repeat the statement that out of the blending and harmonizing of two or more minds, 12 or 13 minds appear to be the most favorable number, may be produced a mind which has the capacity to tune in on the vibrations of the ether and pick up from that source kindred thoughts on any subject. Through the principle of harmony of minds, Ford, Edison, and Firestone have created a mastermind that now supplements the efforts of each of the three. And whether consciously or unconsciously, this mastermind is the cause of the success of each of the three. There is no other answer to their attainment of great power and their far-reaching success in their respective fields of endeavor. And this is true despite the fact that neither of them may be conscious of the power they have created or the manner in which they have done so. In the city of Chicago lie 6 powerful men known as the Big Six. These 6 men are said to be the most powerful group of men in the Midwest. It is said that their combined income totals more than $25 million a year. Every man in this group began in the most humblest circumstances. Their names are William Wrigley Jr., who owns the Wrigley Chewing Gum business, and whose income is said to be over $15 million a year. J.R. Thompson, who owns a chain of Thompson self-help lunchrooms throughout the country. Mr. Lasker, who owns the Lord and Thomas Advertising Agency. Mr. McCullough, who owns the largest express business in the world. And Mr. Ritchie and Mr. Hertz, who own the yellow taxicab business of the country. There is nothing startling about a man who does nothing more than become a millionaire as a rule. However, there is something connected with the financial success of these particular millionaires that is more than startling. For it is well known that there exists between them a bond of friendship, out of which has grown the condition of harmony that produces a mastermind. These 6 men, whether by accident or design, have blended their minds in such a way that the mind of each has been supplanted by a superhuman power known as the mastermind. And that mind has brought each of them more worldly gain than any person could possibly use to advantage. The law upon which the principle of a mastermind operates was discovered by Christ when he surrounded himself with 12 disciples and created the first 13 club of the world. Despite the fact that one of the 13, Judas, broke the chain of harmony, sufficient seed was sown during the period of harmony that originally existed between these 13 people to ensure the continuation of the greatest and most far-reaching philosophy known to the inhabitants of this earth. Many millions of people believe themselves to possess wisdom. Many of these do possess wisdom in certain elementary stages. But no man may possess real wisdom without the aid of the power known as a mastermind. And such a mind cannot be created except through the principle of blending in harmony of 2 or more minds. Through many years of practical experimentation, it has been found that 13 minds, when blended in a spirit of perfect harmony, produce the most practical results. Upon this principle, whether consciously or unconsciously, is founded all on the great industrial and commercial success that are so abundant in this age. The word merger is becoming one of the most popular words in newspaper parlance, because hardly a day goes by that one may not read of some big industrial, commercial, financial, or railroad merger. Slowly the world is beginning to learn, in a very few minds only, that through friendly alliance and cooperation, great power may be developed. The successful business and industrial and financial enterprises are those managed by leaders who either consciously or unconsciously apply the principle of coordinated effort described in this article. If you would be a great leader in any undertaking, Surround yourself with other minds that can be blended in the spirit of cooperation so that they act and function as one. If you can grasp this principle and apply it, you may have, for your efforts, whatever you want on this earth. End of chapter. End of lesson 9. The Law of Success, Lesson 10, Pleasing Personality. You can do it if you believe you can. What is an attractive personality? Of course, the answer is a personality that attracts. But what causes a personality to attract? Let us proceed to find out. Your personality is the sum total of your characteristics and appearances, which distinguish you from all others. The clothes you wear, the lines in your face, the tone of your voice, the thoughts you think, the character you have developed by those thoughts, all constitute parts of your personality. Whether your personality is attractive or not is another matter. By far the most important part of your personality is that which is represented by your character, and is therefore the part that is not visible. The style of your clothes and their appropriateness undoubtedly constitutes a very important part of your personality, for it is true that people form first impressions of you from your outward appearance. Even the manner in which you shake hands forms an important part of your personality, and goes a very long way toward attracting or repelling those with whom you shake hands. This art can be cultivated. The expression of your eyes also forms an important part of your personality, for there are people, and they are more numerous than one might imagine, who can look through your eyes into your heart and see that which is written there by the nature of your most secret thoughts. The vitality of your body, sometimes called personal magnetism, also constitutes an important part of your personality. Now let us proceed to arrange these outward mediums through which the nature of our personality is expressed, so that it will attract and not repel. There is one way in which you can so express the composite of your personality that it will always attract, even though you may be as homely as the circus fat woman, and this is by taking a keen-hearted interest in the other fellow's game in life. Let me illustrate exactly what is meant by relating an incident that happened some years ago, from which I was taught a lesson in master salesmanship. One day an old lady called at my office and sent in her card with a message saying that she must see me personally. No amount of coaxing by secretaries could induce her to disclose the nature of her visit. Therefore, I made up my mind that she was some poor old soul who wanted to sell me a book, and remembering that my own mother was a woman, I decided to go out of the reception room and buy her book, whatever it may be. Please follow every detail thoughtfully, for you too may learn a lesson in master salesmanship from this incident. As I walked down the hallway from my private office, this old lady, who was standing just outside of the railing that led to the main reception room, began to smile. I had seen many people smile, but never before had I seen one who smiled so sweetly as did this lady. It was one of those contagious smiles, because I caught the spirit of it and began to smile also. As I reached the railing, the old lady extended her hand to shake hands with me. Now, as a rule, I do not become too friendly on first acquaintances when a person calls at my office, for the reason that it is very hard to say no if the caller should ask me to do that which I do not wish to do. However, this dear old lady looked so sweetly innocent and harmless that I extended my hand and she began to shake it, whereupon I discovered that she not only had an attractive smile, but she also had a magnetic handshake. She took hold of my hand firmly, but not too firmly, and the very manner in which she went about it telegraphed the thought to my brain that it was she who was doing the honors. She made me feel that she was really and truly glad to shake my hand, and I believe that she was. I believe that her handshake came from the heart as well as from the hand. I have shaken hands with many thousands of people during my public career, but I do not recall having ever done so with anyone who understood the art of doing it as well as this old lady did. The moment she touched my hand, I could feel myself slipping, and I knew that whatever it was that she had come after, she would go away with it, and that I would aid and abet her all I could towards this end. In other words, the penetrating smile and that warm handshake had disarmed me, and made me a willing victim. At a single stroke, this old lady had shorn me of all the false shell in which I could crawl when salesmen come around selling, or trying to sell, that which I do not want. To go back to an expression which you found quite frequently in previous lessons of this course, this gentle visitor had neutralized my mind and made me want to listen. Ah, but here is the stumbling point at which most salespeople fall and break their necks, figuratively speaking. For it is as useless to try to sell a man something until you have first made him want to listen, as it would be to command the earth to stop rotating. Note well how this old lady used a smile and a handshake as the tools with which to pry open the window that led to my heart. But the most important part of the transaction is yet to be related. Slowly and deliberately, as if she had all the time there was in the universe, which she did have as far as I was concerned at that moment, the old lady began to crystallize the first step of her victory into reality by saying, "I just came here to tell you," what seemed to me to be a long pause, "that I think you are doing the most wonderful work of any man in the world today." Every word was emphasized by a gentle, though firm, squeeze of my hand, and as she was looking through my eyes and into my heart as she spoke. After I regained consciousness, for it became a standing joke among my assistants at the office that I fainted dead away, I reached down and unlocked the little secret latch that fastened the gate and said, "Come right in, dear lady. Come right in to my private office." And with a gallant bow that would have done credit to the cavaliers of olden times, I bade her come in and sit a while. As she entered my private office, I motioned her to a big easy chair back of my desk while I took the little hard-seated chair, which under normal circumstances I would have used as a means of discouraging her from taking up too much of my time. For 3/4 of an hour, I listened to one of the most brilliant and charming conversations I have ever heard, and my visitor was doing all the conversing. From the very start, she had assumed the initiative and taken the lead, and up to the end of the first 3/4 of an hour, she found no inclination on my part to challenge her right to it. I repeat, lest you do not get the full importance of this, that I was a willing listener. Now comes the part of the story which would make me blush with embarrassment if it were not for the fact that you and I are separated by the pages of this book. But I must summon the courage with which to tell you the facts, because the entire incident would lose its significance if I fail to do so. As I have stated, my visitor entranced me with brilliant and captivating conversation for 3/4 of an hour. Now what do you suppose she was talking about all that time? No, you are wrong. She was not trying to sell me a book, nor did she once use the personal pronoun I. However, she was not only trying, but actually selling me something, and that something was myself. She had no sooner been seated in that big cushioned chair than she unrolled a package which I had mistaken for a book that she had come to sell me. And sure enough, there was a book in the package, in fact several of them, for she had a complete year's file of the magazine of which I was then editor, Hill's Golden Rule. She turned the pages of those magazines and read places that she had marked here and there, assuring me, in the meanwhile, that she had always believed the philosophy back of that which she was reading. Then, after I was in a state of complete mesmerism and thoroughly receptive, my visitor tactfully switched the conversation to a subject which I suspect she had in mind to discuss with me long before she presented herself at my office. But, and this is another point at which most salespeople blunder, had she reversed the order of her conversation and begun where she finished, the chances are that she never would have had the opportunity to sit in the big easy chair. During the last 3 minutes of her visit, she skillfully laid before me the merits of some securities that she was selling. She did not ask me to purchase, but the way in which she told me of the merits of the securities, plus the way in which she had so impressively told me of the merits of my own game, had the psychological effect of causing me to want to purchase. And even though I made no purchase of securities from her, she made a sale, because I picked up the telephone and introduced her to a man to whom she later sold more than 5 times the amount that she had intended selling me. If that same woman, or another woman or a man, who had the tact and personality that she possessed, should call on me, I would again sit down and listen for 3/4 of an hour. We are all human, and we are all more or less vain. We are all alike in this respect. We will listen with intense interest to those who have the tact to talk to us about that which lies closest to our hearts. And then, out of the sense of reciprocity, we will also listen with interest when the speaker finally switches the conversation to the subject which lies closest to his or her heart. And at the end, we will not only sign on the dotted line, but we will say, "What a wonderful personality." In the city of Chicago some years ago, I was conducting a school of salesmanship for Securities Health, which employed more than 1,500 salespeople. To keep the ranks of that big organization filled, we had to train and employ 600 new salespeople every week. Of all the thousands of men and women who went through the school, there was but one man who grasped the significance of the principle I am here describing, the first time he heard it analyzed. This man had never tried to sell securities and frankly admitted when he entered the salesmanship class that he was not a salesman. Let's see whether he was or not. After he had finished the training, one of the star salesmen took a notion to play a practical joke on him, believing him to be a credulous person who would believe all that he heard. So this star gave him an inside tip as to where he would be able to sell some securities without any great effort. This star would make the sale himself, so he said, but the man to whom he referred as being a likely purchaser was an ordinary artist who would purchase with so little urging that he, being a star, did not wish to waste his time on him. The newly made salesman was delighted to receive the tip, and forthwith he was on his way to make the sale. As soon as he was out of the office, the star gathered the other stars around him and told of the joke he was playing. For in reality, the artist was a very wealthy man, and the star himself had spent nearly a month trying to sell him, but without success. It then developed that all the other stars of that particular group had called on this same artist, but had failed to interest him. The newly made salesman was gone about an hour and a half. When he returned, he found the stars waiting for him with smiles on their faces. To their surprise, the newly made salesman also wore a broad smile on his face. The stars looked at each other inquiringly, for they had expected that this green man would not return in a joyful mood. "Well, did you sell to your man?" inquired the originator of this joke. "Certainly," replied the uninitiated one, "and I found that artist to be all you said he was, a perfect gentleman and a very interesting man." Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out an order and a check for $2,000. The stars wanted to know how he did it. "Oh, it wasn't difficult," replied the newly made salesman. "I just walked in and talked to him a few minutes, and he brought up the subject of the securities himself, and said he wanted to purchase. Therefore, I really did not sell to him. He purchased it of his own accord." When I heard of the transaction, I called the newly made salesman in and asked him to describe, in detail, just how he made the sale, and I will relate it just as he told it. When he reached the artist's studio, he found him at work on a picture. So engaged in his work was the artist that he did not see the salesman enter. So the salesman walked over to where he could see the picture and stood there looking at it without saying a word. Finally, the artist saw him. Then the salesman apologized for the intrusion and began to talk about the picture that the artist was painting. He knew just enough about art to be able to discuss the merits of the picture with some intelligence, and he was really interested in the subject. He liked the picture and frankly told the artist so, which of course made the artist very angry. For nearly an hour, these two men talked of nothing but art, particularly that picture that stood on the artist's easel. Finally, the artist asked the salesman his name and his business, and the salesman, yes, the master salesman, replied, "Oh, never mind my business or my name. I am more interested in you and your art." The artist's face beamed with a smile of joy. Those words fell as sweet music upon his ears. But not to be outdone by his polite visitor, he insisted on knowing what mission had brought him to his studio. Then, with an air of genuine reluctance, this master salesman, this real star, introduced himself and told his business. Briefly, he described the securities he was selling, and the artist listened as he enjoyed every word that was spoken. After the salesman had finished, the artist said, "Well, well, I have been very foolish. Other salesmen from your firm have been here trying to sell me some of those securities, but they talked nothing but business. In fact, they annoyed me so that I had to ask one of them to leave. Now let me see, what was that fellow's name? Oh yes, it was Mr. Perkins. Perkins was the star who had thought of this clever trick to play on the newly made salesman. But you present the matter so differently, and now I see how foolish I have been, and I want you to let me have $2,000 worth of these securities. Think of that. You present the matter so differently. And how did this newly made salesman present the matter so differently? Putting the question another way, what did this master salesman really sell the artist? Did he sell him securities? No, he sold him his own picture, which he was painting on his own canvas. The securities were but an incident. Don't overlook this point. That master salesman had remembered the story of the old lady who entertained me for 3/4 of an hour by talking about that which was nearest my heart, and it had so impressed me that he made up his mind to study his prospective purchaser and find out what would interest them most, so he could talk about that. This green, newly made salesman earned $7,900 in commission the first month he was in the field, leading the next highest man by more than double. And the tragedy of it was that not one person out of the entire organization of 1,500 salespeople took the time to find out how and why he became the real star of the organization, a fact which I believe fully justifies the rather biting reprimand suggested in Lesson 9, to which you may have taken offense. A Carnegie or a Rockefeller or a James J. Hill or a Marshall Field accumulates a fortune through the application of the selfsame principles that are available to all the remainder of us. But we envy them their wealth without ever thinking of studying their philosophy and appropriating it for our own use. We look at a successful man in the hour of his triumph and wonder how he did it. But we overlook the importance of analyzing his methods, and we forget the price he had to pay in careful, well-organized preparation, which had to be made before he could reap the fruits of his effort. Throughout this course on the law of success, you will not find a single new principle. Every one of them is as old as civilization itself. Yet you will find but few people who seem to understand how to apply them. The salesman who sold the securities to that artist was not only a master salesman, but he was a man with an attractive personality. He was not much to look at. Perhaps that is why the star conceived the idea of playing that cruel joke on him. But even a homely person may have a very attractive personality in the eyes of those whose handiwork he is praised. Of course, there are some who will get the wrong conception of the principle I am here trying to clear, by drawing the conclusion that any sort of cheap flattery will take the place of genuine heart interest. I hope you are not one of those. I hope that you are one of those who understand the real psychology upon which this lesson is based, and that you will make it your business to study other people closely enough to find something about them or their work that you really admire. Only in this way can you develop a personality that will be irresistibly attractive. Cheap flattery has just the opposite effect to that of constituting an attractive personality. It repels instead of attracts. It is so shallow that even the ignorant easily detect it. Perhaps you have observed, and if you have not, I wish you to do so, that this lesson emphasizes at length the importance of making it your business to take a keen interest in other people and in their work, business, or profession. This emphasis was by no means an accident. You will quickly observe that the principles upon which this lesson is based are very closely related to those which constitute the foundation of Lesson 6 on Imagination. Also, you will observe that this lesson is based upon much of the same general principles as those which form the most important part of Lesson 3 on Cooperation. Let us here introduce some very practical suggestions as to how the laws of imagination, cooperation, and pleasing personality may be blended or coordinated to profitable ends through the creation of usable ideas. Every thinker knows that ideas are the beginning of all successful achievements. The question most often asked is, how can I learn to create ideas that will earn money? In part, we will answer this question in this lesson by suggesting some new and novel ideas, any of which might be developed and made very profitable by almost anyone in practically any locality. Idea number one. The World War has deprived Germany of her enormous trade in toys. Before the war, we bought most of our toys from Germany. We are not likely to buy any more toys from German manufacturers in our time or for a long time afterward. Toys are in demand, not only in the United States but in foreign countries, many of which will not buy toys from Germany. Our only competitor is Japan, and her toys are of so poor a quality that her competition means nothing. But what sort of toys shall I manufacture and where will I get the capital with which to carry on the business, you will ask? First, go to a local toy dealer and find out just which class of toy sells most rapidly. If you do not feel competent to make improvements of some of the toys now on the market, advertise for an inventor with an idea for a marketable toy, and you will soon find the mechanical genius who will supply this missing link in your undertaking. Have him make you a working model of just what you want. Then go to some small manufacturer, woodworker, machine shop, and the like, and arrange to have your toys manufactured. You now know just what your toy will cost, so you are ready to go to some big jobber, wholesaler, or distributor, and arrange for the sale of your entire product. If you are an able salesman, you can finance this whole project on a few dollars required with which to advertise for the inventor. When you find this man, you can probably arrange with him to work out a model for you during his evening spare hours, with a promise that you will give him a better job when you are manufacturing your own toys. He will probably give you all the time you want in which to pay him for his labor, or he may do the work in return for an interest in the business. You can get the manufacturer of your toys to wait for his money until you are paid by the firm to which you sell them, and if necessary, you can assign to him the invoices for the toys sold and let the money come direct to him. Of course, if you have an unusually pleasing and convincing personality and considerable ability to organize, you will be able to take the working model of your toy to some man of means and, in return for an interest in your business, secure the capital with which to do your own manufacturing. If you want to know what will sell, watch a crowd of children at play. Study their likes and dislikes. Find out what will amuse them, and you will probably get an idea of which to build your toy. It requires no genius to invent. Common sense is all that is necessary. Simply find out what the people want and then produce it. Produce it well, better than anyone else is doing. Give it a touch of individuality. Make it distinctive. We spend millions of dollars annually for toys with which to entertain our children. Make your new toy useful as well as interesting. Make it educational if possible. If it entertains and teaches at the same time, it will sell readily and live forever. If your toy is in the nature of a game, make it teach the child something about the world in which it lives. Geography, arithmetic, English, physiology, etc. Or better still, produce a toy that will cause the child to run, jump, or in some other way exercise. Children love to move about, and moving about is of benefit to them, especially when stimulated by the play motive. An indoor baseball game would be a ready seller, especially in the cities. Work out an arrangement for attaching a ball to a string that will be suspended from the ceiling so one child may throw the ball against the wall and then stand back and strike it with a bat as it rebounds. A one-child baseball game, in other words. Plan number two. This will be of interest only to the man or woman who has the self-confidence and the ambition to run the risk of making a big income, which, we may add, most people have not. It is a suggestion that could be put into practical operation by at least 40 or 50 people in every large city throughout the United States, and by a smaller number in smaller cities. It is intended for the man or woman who can write or will learn to write advertising copy, sales literature, follow-up letters, collection letters, and the like, using the ability to write, which we all suppose that you possess. To make practical and profitable use of this suggestion, you will need the cooperation of a good advertising agency and from 1 to 5 firms or individuals who do enough advertising to warrant their appropriation going through an agency. You should go to the agency first and make arrangement with it to employ you and pay you 7% of the gross expenditures of all accounts which you bring to it. This 7% to compensate you for getting the account and for writing the copy and otherwise serving the client in the management of his advertising appropriation. Any reliable agency will gladly give you this amount for all the business you can bring. Then you go to a firm or individual whose advertising account you wish to handle and say in effect that you wish to go to work without compensation. Tell what you can do and what you intend to do for that particular firm that will help it sell more goods. If the firm employs an advertising manager, you are to become virtually his assistant without pay, on one condition. Namely, that the advertising appropriation is to be placed through the agency with which you have the connection. Through this arrangement, the firm or individual whose account you thus secure will get the benefit of your personal services without cost, and pay no more for placing its advertising through your agency than it would through any other. If your canvas is convincing and you really take the time to prepare your case, you will get your account without much argument. You can repeat this transaction until you have as many counts as you can handle advantageously, which under ordinary conditions will be not more than 10 or 12, probably less if one or more of your clients spends upwards of $25,000 a year in advertising. If you are a competent writer of advertising copy and have the ability to create new and profitable ideas for your clients, you will be able to hold their business from year to year. You, of course, understand that you are not to accept more accounts than you can handle individually. You should spend a portion of your time in the place of business of each of your clients. In fact, you should have a desk and a working equipment right on the grounds, so you can get first-hand information as to your client's sales problem, as well as accurate information as to their goods and wares. Through this sort of effort, you will give the advertising agency a reputation for effective service, such as it would get in no other way. And you will please your clients because they will see satisfactory returns from your efforts. As long as you keep the agency and the clients whom you serve satisfied, your job is safe and you will make money. A reasonable expectation of returns under this plan would be a gross business of $250,000 a year, on which your 7% would amount to $17,500. A man or woman of unusual ability could run the figure much higher than this, up to, say, an income of $25,000 a year, while the tendency would be, however, to drop down to around $5,000 to $7,500, which are the figures that the average man or woman might reasonably expect to earn. You can see that the plan has possibilities. It supplies independent work and gives you 100% of your earning power. It is better than a position as advertising manager, even if the position paid the same money, because it practically places you in a business of your own, one in which your name is constantly developing a survival value. Plan number 3. This plan can be put into operation by almost any man or woman of average intelligence, and with but little preparation. Go to any first-class printer and make arrangements with him to handle all the business you bring to him, allowing you a commission of, say, 10% on the gross amount. Then go to the largest user of printed matter and get samples of everything in the way of printing that they use. Form a partnership or working arrangement with a commercial artist, who will go over all his printed matter, and wherever suitable or appropriate, he will improve the illustrations or make illustrations where none were used before, making a rough pencil sketch which can be pasted to the original printed matter. Then, if you are not a writer of copy, form a working arrangement with someone who is, and get him or her to go over the copy of the printed matter and improve it in every respect possible. When the work is complete, go back to the firm for who you got the printed matter, taking with you quotations on the work and show what can be done in the way of improvement. Say nothing about your quotations, however, until you have shown how much you can improve the printed matter. You will probably get the entire business of that firm by giving that sort of service in connection with every job of printing that has to be done. If you perform your service properly, you will soon have all the business that your commercial artist, your copywriter, and you can handle. It ought to be good for $5,000 a year apiece for you. Any profits that you earn from the work of others in connection with any of these plans will be a legitimate profit, a profit to which you will be entitled in return for your ability to organize and bring together the necessary talent and ability with which to perform satisfactory service. If you go into the toy business, you will be entitled to a profit on the work of those who make the toys, because it will be through your ability that employment for them is available. It is more than likely that your brains and your ability, when added to that of those who work with you or for you, will greatly increase their earning capacity, even to the extent that they can well afford to see you make a small amount from their efforts, because they will be still earning much more than they could earn without your guidance. You are willing to take any of these plans and make a profit out of them, are you not? You see nothing wrong on your part, do you? If you are an employee working for some other person or firm, may it not be possible that the head of that firm or individual, with his ability to organize, finance, etc., is increasing your own earnings capacity right now? You want to get out of the employee class and become an employer. We do not blame you for that. Nearly every normal person wants to do the same. The one best first step to take is to serve the firm or individual for whom you are working just as you would wish to be served if you were the individual or the head of that firm. Who are the big employers of help today? Are they the rich man's son who fell heir to employership? Not on your life. They are the men and women who came up from the ranks of the most lowly sort of labor. Men and women who have had no greater opportunity than you have. They are in the positions that you hold because your superior ability has enabled them intelligently to direct others. You can acquire that ability if you will try. Right in the town or city where you live, there are people who probably could benefit by knowing you, and who would undoubtedly benefit you in return. In one section of the city lives John Smith, who wishes to sell his grocery store and open a moving picture theater. In another section of the store is a man who has a moving picture theater that he would like to trade for a grocery store. Can you bring them together? If you can, you will serve both and earn a nice remuneration. In your town or city are people who want to products raised on the farm in the surrounding community. On those farms are farmers who raise farm products and who want to get them into the hands of those who live in town. If you can find a way of carrying the farm products direct from the farm to the city or town consumer, you will enable the farmer to get more for his products and the consumer to get these products for less. And still, there will be a margin to pay you for your ingenuity in shortening the route between the producer and consumer. In business, there are, broadly speaking, two classes of people, the producers and the consumers. The tendency of the things is to find some way of bringing these two together without so many intermediaries. Find a way to shorten the route between producer and consumer, and you will have created a plan that will help these two classes and handsomely profit you. The laborer is worthy of his hire. If you can create such a plan, you are entitled to a fair proportion of that which you save for the consumer, and also a fair proportion of that which you make for the producer. Let us warn you that whatever plan you create as a means of making money, you had better see that it slices off a little of the cost to the consumer instead of adding a little to that cost. The business of bringing produce and consumer together is a profitable business when it is conducted fairly to both, and without a greedy desire to get all there is in sight. The American public is wonderfully patient with profiteers who impose upon them, but there is a pivotal point beyond which even the shrewdest of them dare not go. It may be all right to corner the diamond market and run up enormous high the price of those white rocks which are dug out of the ground in Africa without trouble. But when the prices of food and clothing and other necessities begin to soar skyward, there is a chance of someone getting into the bad graces of the American public. If you crave wealth and are really brave enough to shoulder the burdens which go with it, reverse the usual method of acquiring it by giving your goods and wares to the world at the lowest possible profit you can afford, instead of exacting all that you can with safety. Ford has found it profitable to pay his workers not as little as he can get them for, but as much as his profits will permit. He has also found it profitable to reduce the price of his automobiles to the consumer, while other manufacturers, many of whom have long since failed, continue to increase their prices. There may be some perfectly good plans through the operation of which you could squeeze the consumer and still manage to keep out of jail, but you enjoy much more peace of mind and in all probability more profits in the long run if your plan, when you complete it, is built along the Ford lines. You have heard John D. Rockefeller abused considerably, but most of this abuse has been prompted by sheer envy upon the part of those who would like to have his money, but who haven't the inclination to earn it. Regardless of your opinion of Rockefeller, do not forget that he began as a humble bookkeeper, and that he gradually climbed to the top in the accumulation of money, because of his ability to organize and direct other and less able men intelligently. This author can remember when he had to pay 25 cents for a gallon of lamp oil and walk 2 miles through the hot sun and carry it home in a tin can in the bargain. Now, Rockefeller's wagon will deliver it at the back door, in the city or on the farm, at a little over half that sum. Who has a right to begrudge Rockefeller his millions as long as he has reduced the price of a needed commodity? He could just as easily have increased the price of lamp oil to half a dollar, but we seriously doubt that he would be a multimillionaire today if he had done so. There are a lot of us who want money, but 99 out of every 100 who start to create a plan through which to get money give all their thought to the scheme through which to get a hold of it, and no thought to the service to be given in return for it. A pleasing personality is one that makes use of imagination and cooperation. We have cited the foregoing illustrations on how ideas may be created to show you how to coordinate the laws of imagination, cooperation, and a pleasing personality. Analyze any man who does not have a pleasing personality, and you will find lacking in that man the faculties of imagination and cooperation also. This brings us to a suitable place at which to introduce one of the greatest lessons on personality ever placed on paper. It is also one of the most effective lessons on salesmanship ever written. For the subjects of attractive personality and the salesmanship must also go hand in hand. They are inseparable. I have referenced to Shakespeare's masterpiece, Mark Antony's speech at the funeral of Caesar. Perhaps you have read this oration, but it is here presented with interpretations and parentheses which may help you to gather new meaning from it. The setting for that oration was something like the following. Caesar is dead, and Brutus, his slayer, is called on to tell the Roman mob that is gathered at the undertaker's why he put Caesar out of the way. Picture in your imagination a howling mob that was none too friendly to Caesar, and that already believed that Brutus had done a noble deed by murdering him. Brutus takes the platform and makes a short statement of his reasons for killing Caesar. Confident that he has won the day, he takes his seat. His whole demeanor is that of one who believes his word will be accepted without question. It is one of haughtiness. Mark Antony now takes the platform, knowing that the mob is antagonistic to him because he is a friend of Caesar. In a low, humble tone of voice, Antony begins to speak. Antony, for Brutus' sake, I am beholding to you. Fourth citizen, what does he say of Brutus? Third citizen, he says, for Brutus' sake, he finds himself beholding to us all. Fourth citizen, 'twere best he speaks no harm of Brutus here. First citizen, this Caesar was a tyrant. Third citizen, nay, that's certain. We are blessed that Rome is rid of him. Second citizen, peace, let us hear what Antony can say. Here you will observe in Antony's opening statements his clever method of neutralizing the minds of his listeners. Antony, you gentle Romans, parentheses, about as gentle as a gang of Bolsheviks in a revolutionary labor meeting. All, peace ho, let us hear him. Had Antony begun his speech by knocking Brutus, the history of Rome would have been different. Antony, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. Align himself with what he knew to be the state of mind of his listeners. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft inferred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it was a grievous fault. And grievously bathed Caesar answered it. Here under the leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man, so are they all honorable men, come I to speak at Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. He hath brought many captives home to Rome, whose ransom did the general coffer fill. Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? When the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. You all did see that on the Lupercal I thrice presented him a kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse, was this ambition. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and surely he is an honorable man. I speak not to disprove what Brutus spoke, but here I am to speak what I do know. You all did love him once, not without cause. What cause withholds you then to mourn for him? O judgment, thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reasons, bear with me. My heart is in the coffin there with Caesar, and I must pause till it come back to me. At this point, Antony paused to give his audience a chance to discuss hurriedly among themselves his opening statements. His object in doing this was to observe what effect his words were having, just as a master salesman always encourages his prospective purchasers to talk so he may know what is in his mind. First citizen, methinks there is much in his saying. Second citizen, if thou consider rightly of the matter, Caesar has had great wrong. Third citizen, has he, masters? I fear there will be worse to come in his place. Fourth citizen, marked ye his words. He would not take the crown, therefore 'tis certain he was not ambitious. First citizen, if it be found so, someone will dear abide it. Second citizen, poor soul, his eyes are red as fire with weeping. Third citizen, there's not a nobler man in Rome than Antony. Fourth citizen, now mark him, he begins again to speak. Antony, but yesterday the word of Caesar might have stood against the world, now lies he there, and none so poor to do him reverence. O masters, if I were disposed to stir your hearts and minds to mutiny and rage, I should do Brutus wrong and Cassius wrong, who, you all know, are honorable men. Observe how often Antony has repeated the term honorable. Observe also how cleverly he brings in the first suggestion that perhaps Brutus and Cassius may not be as honorable as the Roman mob believes them to be. This suggestion is carried in the words mutiny and rage, which he here uses for the first time, after his pause gave him time to observe that the mob was swinging over toward his side of the argument. Observe how carefully he is feeling his way and making his words fit that which he knows to be the frame of mind of the listeners. Antony, I will not do them wrong. I rather choose to wrong the dead, to wrong myself and you, than I will wrong such honorable men. Crystallization, his suggestion into hatred of Brutus and Cassius, he then appeals to their curiosity and begins to lay the foundation for his climax, a climax which he knows will win the mob because he is reaching it so cleverly that the mob believes it to be its own conclusion. Antony, but here's a parchment with the seal of Caesar. I found it in his closet. 'Tis his will. Let but the commons hear his testaments, which, pardon me, I do not mean to read. Tightening up on his appeal to their curiosity by making them believe he does not intend to read the will. And they would go and kiss dead Caesar's wounds, and dip their napkins in his sacred blood, yea, beg a hair of him for memory, and dying mention it within their wills, bequeathing it as a rich legacy unto their issue. Human nature always wants that which is difficult to get, or that of which is about to be deprived. Observe how craftily Antony has awakened the interest of the mob and made them want to hear the reading of the will, thereby preparing them to hear it with open minds. This marks his second step in the process of neutralizing their minds. All. The will, we will hear Caesar's will. Antony. Have patience, gentle friends. I must not read it. It is not mate you know how Caesar loved you. You are not wood, you are not stones, but men. And being men, hearing the will of Caesar, it will inflame you. It will make you mad. 'Tis good you know not that you are as hares. For if you should, oh, what will come of it? Fourth citizen, read the will, we will hear it. Antony, you shall read us the will, Caesar's will. Will you be patient? Will you stay a while? I have or hurt myself to tell you of it. I fear I wrong the honorable men. Whose daggers have stabbed Caesar's, I do fear it.